Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Michael Heaney. He is Assistant Professor of Organizational Studies and Political Science at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And importantly, he is the co-author of a significant new book that I highly recommend. He's a co-author with Fabio Rojas of Party in the Streets, the Anti-War Movement and the Democratic Party After 9/11. Michael Heaney, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me here, David.
It's great to have you here. You have, I think, an important claim and evidence to back it up, both about why the peace movement grew around 2003, 2004 or so, you can give us the exact dates, and why it shrank again around 2007 or 8 or 9. What's your argument?
Our argument is that there's a close connection between political parties and social movements in terms of the way that people think about themselves. So one of the most powerful resources that a social movement has to it is the identities that people have with the cause and with the issues and with the movement. What we found with the anti-war movement is that was closely connected with people's identities as Democrats. And so that was a two-edged sword. On the upswing of the movement, Democratic identities helped to amplify the movement and grow the movement and fuel the movement. Then, once the Democratic Party started getting electoral success in 2006, 2008, those same identities redirected many activist efforts to other causes away from the movement. So, unfortunately, at exactly the time when the movement was most well poised to exert influence in Washington, many of its participants backed away on their own accord because of the way that they identified with political parties.
It's interesting, both the plus and the negative there, because some of us were actively trying to organize people to oppose wars when the president happened to be a Republican. We were happy to go along with opposing that Republican and making it his war and opposing it as his war. But it seems like if we hadn't done that, your argument is we would have had much less success. That is, if the president hadn't been a Republican and we hadn't been combining people's desires to oppose war with opposing Bush and Cheney, we wouldn't have gotten nearly as far.
Well, it is very tricky. And the reason why it's so tricky is that political parties really are the mass objects out there in the political system. So they're the things that most people are familiar with, the things that you can talk about that people relate to and understand. And so, yes, it made a lot of sense in 2003, 2004, 2005 to say, even 2006, to say, this is Bush's war, Bush lied, we need to get rid of Bush. But the upside of that is during those times, you're stoking people's partisan identities and people are turning out and saying, yes, I don't like Bush, and I'm going to turn out and I'm going to be for this movement and try to stop Bush. The problem is that then you're also teaching people not that war is the problem, but you're teaching them that Bush is the problem, that the Republicans are the problem. And then when Bush is no longer there, the Republicans are no longer there, basically you've educated your activists that they don't need to be there either. So the difficulty is then, you know, how do you have a different kind of education? You know, so it seems like the approach that wouldn't have that effect would be an approach that was genuinely nonpartisan, the approach that was genuinely issue-oriented, that emphasized, for example, both the conservative and liberal arguments against war. The advantage of that is then you wouldn't have, if you could build the movement in that way, then you wouldn't have this sharp decline when the parties changed. The disadvantage of that approach is that at the outset it would be much less effective, right? So you wouldn't have been able, if you had had simply an objective analysis of war without stoking partisan identities, you wouldn't have had the large rallies that you had in 2003, 2004, 2005. So it's hard to know how to balance those two things. And of course, all of this is set within a political context in the United States that's heavily polarized on the basis of partisanship, so that people in general, even if you don't tell them to, think about issues in a very partisan way. And so it's hard to fight against that.
Of course, we said, many of us said and believed that we don't want, you know, Bush impeached because he's a Republican, and we don't want him replaced with someone because they would be a Democrat. We want someone in there who knows if I do these sorts of things, I too will be impeached. But of course, nobody heard that. Everyone said, you hate Bush, you hate the Republicans.
And it's difficult to hear that because of the way that people are socialized into their political identities. And what has been true in America for a long time, and I think what has become even more true in recent years, is that party has become the defining dominant way of thinking about politics. And it hasn't always been that way. I mean, there's, like, for example, if you were to go back to the Vietnam War era, the nation was polarized during that time as well, but partisanship was not really the basis of polarization. There were other bases of polarization, issues, region, those kinds of things divided the country. And therefore, it was possible for issue movements to come along and make headway. But when the parties divide, when the country's divided so much on the basis of partisanship, it's much more difficult to educate people about how they should think about the issue rather than the party.
Let's get, before we get to that in too much depth, let's get to the drop-off. When did the peace movement shrivel away, and why?
Well, I would say that things start to decline in mid to late 2007. There was a sort of burst of energy immediately after the 2006 midterm elections, when the Democrats claimed both the House and the Senate in the midterm elections. And then what happens is that, and in fact, there's a real intensification of organizing efforts by the anti-war movement in 2007, but people start to become less responsive to those calls. So as the Democratic Party starts to attain electoral success starting in 2006 and takes over the Congress, anti-war rallies start to shrink. And then once President Obama is elected, basically it falls off to almost nothing. I mean, maybe not almost nothing, but rallies go from being in the hundreds of thousands to being 1,000 or less almost immediately after Obama's election.
Now, some people would argue, and perhaps this is the incredible power of their partisan goggles through which they view the world, but some people would argue that the wars went away, and that's why the peace movement went away, because it won and the wars ended. You right. have some arguments and some statistics and actually some graphics of numbers of troops abroad and so forth that weigh against that claim.
Yes, we look carefully at this, and I don't think you can sustain the argument that the peace movement went away because the war went away. More or less, President Obama carried out the same policies that the Bush administration had in place. Now, you could quibble with that. You could make an argument that says the Obama administration was a little bit more peace-oriented than the Republicans were. Likewise, you could probably make an argument that the Obama administration was a little bit more bellicose if you look at what was happening in Afghanistan. But I think that when you really look at the evidence, you see that the Bush foreign policy and the Obama foreign policy look pretty similar. What you see is you see the peace movement declining in terms of its demobilization while Bush is pushing the surge. So you see troop levels increasing in Iraq and Afghanistan at the same time that you see peace rallies going down. You also see President Obama essentially carrying out the same withdrawal plan as the Bush administration. The Obama administration withdrew troops on almost exactly the same timetable that the Bush administration had proposed, with a few deviations. So you're looking at two administrations that have, for all intents and purposes, essentially the same foreign policy.
We're speaking with Michael Heaney, co-author of a tremendous new book called Party in the Streets, The Anti-War Movement and the Democratic Party After 9/11. Michael, it seems to me that we sort of saw this happening at the time, and it was quite open and obvious if anyone wanted to look. I mean, I remember Rahm Emanuel coming in as the leader of the House. I think this was January 07, or not as the leader, but as the number two guy in the House, telling the Washington Post, look, we're not actually going to do anything to end the wars. We'd like to run against them again in 2008. It worked so well in 2006. We'll keep them going. We'll keep calling them Republican, even though we're in charge now and got elected to end them, and then we'll campaign against them again. And it seems to have worked.
Well, this is a general problem with politicians and the political parties, is that often they would rather keep the issue around and continue fighting against the issue than they would solve the problems. So, for example, when you look at election data for the entire decade of the 2000s, you see that the war issue is a winning issue for Democrats all the way through, basically starting in 2002. So, I mean, even when the Democrats are still losing, they're winning among the people that oppose war. So as long as the Democrats could keep that anti-war issue alive and claim as a party that they were against war, and people generally credited the Democrats during the 2000s as being anti-war, the Democrats continued to reap electoral benefits from that position. So it does make sense that you would want to keep that issue alive. And I would say that this is not unique. It's neither unique to the Democrats nor it's unique to war. But it's often the way that politicians work. They rather keep the issue alive than solve the problem effectively.
Now, you and your co-author and your colleagues spend a lot of time at anti-war events surveying people, asking their points of view and their beliefs and the strengths of their beliefs in order to arrive at your conclusions. I didn't do that, but I did spend a lot of time on conference calls and in meetings and watching how the organizations were run, and right. Maybe that shapes our perspectives. But you put a lot of weight, I think, on general public opinion, whether shaped by the mass media or otherwise, in the course of these events. That is, your argument, tell me if I'm wrong, is that the peace movement went away not because the organizations shut it down, but because they tried their best and the public support wasn't there.
Well, I would say we argue a little bit more than that. That's definitely one part of the argument. We have chapter 4, which analyzes those protest surveys. Then we have a chapter 5, which looks at the organizational politics. And then we have a chapter 6, which actually looks at the legislative politics. So we argue that there were declines in both individual participation, organizational participation, and legislative participation that corresponded with these organizational and individual identities with political parties. We argue that the individuals and the organizations decline at different times and for slightly different reasons. So we argue that the individual level participation starts falling off in 2007 in a steep way, but that the organizational participation doesn't fall off quite as much until 2009. So part of the reason for that is that the organizations see the coming Democratic electoral success as an opportunity for them, and they pursue that. They ramp up their efforts, and for the most part, those efforts don't really return the benefits and the gains that they hoped they would. And in fact, those were maybe some of the years that I personally was most active in the peace movement, from 2007 through 2008. I think I literally went to everything between 2007 and 2008. And all around the country, and I watched the organizers trying to step things up and basically not getting a reception among their constituency. But then in 2009, when there might have still been some grassroots support for mobilization, you basically see organizations shut down at a time when my expectation would have been that they would have pick things up because they would have seen the Obama administration as receptive to their point of view. But that was not as much the way that they responded.
Now, see, I remember a divide within the coalitions of organizations that even preceded 2007, but really in January 2007 was in sharp relief, and you had organizations like MoveOn.org that would do sort of phony Stalinist polling of their members. Do you prefer Nancy Pelosi's plan to do almost nothing or George W. Bush's plan to do the same thing? And of course, all the members would say Nancy Pelosi's, and then MoveOn would put out a statement: our members favor Nancy Pelosi's plan to continue the war over Barbara Lee's plan to end it, when Barbara Lee hadn't been on the ballot, right? And this sort of phony pretense of being democratic and following their members' directive, which Eli Pariser of MoveOn.org openly said, we didn't give them the Barbara Lee option because they would have voted for it. This was what we saw with the more Democratic Party-leaning groups, that rather than being populist, rather than being driven by their members who had just elected a new Congress they thought to end the wars, they sought to keep the wars going while pretending to be following their members' will. That seems more organizationally directed than popularly driven.
Okay, we do talk about MoveOn in the book. We didn't follow MoveOn quite as closely as it sounds like you did. And I wouldn't say that I'm in a position to judge whether MoveOn was phony or whether MoveOn did as much as it could have done to oppose the war in 2007-2008. I think that one observation that we would make is that MoveOn was one of those organizations that was working in 2007-2008, and at least based upon what they were saying, seems to have stepped up their game during those years on the anti-war front.
Well, but they,
now, whether that's a sincere desire to increase, stop the war, whether it's a phony ploy to generate member support or revenue or something along those lines, I'm not sure that our evidence really speaks to which of those is more likely.
Right, but they would organize anti-war protests in the districts of Republican war supporters and leave the districts of Democratic war supporters alone.
Right.
So that if you were looking at that from the national perspective at what they were about, it looked more partisan than anti-war.
Yeah. Well, we didn't observe that in particular, but if we had observed that, we definitely would have included that in the book. Because I think that observation, to the extent that it's true, would support the general arc of our argument that the organizations are being guided by their partisan identities more than they're being guided by their issue identities.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so we didn't have that kind of data or those kind of observations.
No, I think the important argument that you make, and it's a strong one, is that both organizations and individuals are being driven by partisanship. I'm just sort of trying to put a little more weight on the organizations, that's all.
Yeah, I think that there's a little bit about, it's hard to tell exactly the timing, and I think that this is, it's also worth making the point that we don't do a lot of delving into people's motivations. We try to very much observe people and organizations and their actions and what they do and what they don't do, and the arguments that we make in the book, we try to base them as much as possible upon the observations that we make and the statistical analysis of those observations. So all that we're arguing that I think differs from yours is you're making a slightly different argument about the timing. You're arguing that some of the organizations withdrew there or didn't put their support into the anti-war movement as much in 2007 and 2008. And we're saying it seems to us that they did. So we're arguing that there's a delay in the decrease among the organizations, and you're saying maybe there wasn't.
Yeah, well, some obviously were growing and putting in more, like Iraq Veterans Against the War, but they are relatively small.
Can I amplify that point? Because that's a great point, and I think that we can't talk about the anti-war movement as a homogenous thing. The anti-war movement is made up of a lot of different constituencies and a lot of different organizations, and there were some organizations that just plowed through and continued to fight on. One organization that comes to mind is just being, eternally vigilant is Code Pink, Women for Peace, who just continued to push, and there was nothing that stopped them. I mean, they're still going on and on in their opposition to war and in opposition to U.S. foreign policy. So definitely some organizations didn't follow this kind of cycle at all. But there were many organizations that did, and it's that overall pattern that we're arguing about in the book.
Right. Understood. And I think it's a critical point. And I think a very interesting point that was really new to me in the book, having known you and read your papers before, I hadn't picked up on this, that you make this contrast with the Vietnam era, that many things were better and many things were worse, but the partisan divide was not the same and was not as strong. Would it be desirable to get back to that less partisan polarity in terms of organizing movements and maintaining them? Would it be desirable? And if so, how would we go about it?
Well, that is a great question. And to be honest, it's the question that I've struggled the most with in thinking about this book. I don't think there's an easy answer. You know, so if you were to look at the 1960s, you know, you saw that it was possible to organize movements that were heavily issue specific, that were heavily effective, that movements that weren't necessarily bipartisan movements, but that the key issue wasn't partisanship. But at the same time, the reason why that was possible is because the country was divided along all these other awful axes, right? So, you know, one of the reasons why the civil rights movement organized across parties is because you had racism both in the Democratic and Republican parties. So you wouldn't want to say, let's go back to an age when we were divided by race more than we were divided by party. So there's the issue is that there's, in the 1960s and the 1950s, even to some extent in the 1970s, the country was being divided by these other things, and I'm not sure we would want to go back to the day where there were these other divisions. But at the same time, I think that what advocates should be pushing for is getting people to think more about issues and seeking every opportunity they can to present the issue and how the issue works, and also to present the issue from both points of view. You know, so for example, one of the things that, I mean, I would characterize myself as a liberal, as a progressive, but one of the things that bothered me most about the anti-war movement was its hesitancy in making conservative arguments against war. You know, so I think one of the best arguments against war is that wars are just extremely expensive, and wars put the country into debt. And wars empower the federal government. I mean, those are all strong conservative arguments. And the anti-war movement was hesitant to make those arguments because there are other issue areas where you might not want to make those kinds of arguments. So
yeah, it's,
I guess what I would do is I would say that the movements themselves have got to look more broadly for support. They've got to look for a wider range of arguments to support their positions. They've got to look for a wider range of groups and organizations. You know, so for example, if an organization like the Cato Institute is willing to come out against the war, you want to bring that group into the movement as much as you can, even though you might disagree with their positions on lots of other issues. You can't. There's too much of in social movements of looking at your potential allies and saying, well, I agree with this ally on issue A, but I disagree with them on issues B, C, D, and E, and so forget it, I don't want to work with them. If you agree with them on issue A, you've got to work with them on issue A. And I think that the movements, in a sense, self-segregate themselves too much. And that is what is, that's at least part of what's undermining their political effectiveness.
Well, I think it's very good advice. I also think it's very difficult for any number of reasons, including
the stupid... Oh, yeah, because you get people together and they start fighting with one another.
Well, that precisely, and because they identify around all these other stupid things, and the libertarians identify as Ron Paulers, and then people oppose some other stupid unrelated thing Ron Paul did, and so forth. But we've tried, you know, and you reach out to libertarian groups and you say, look, let's have a coalition. Let's take hundreds of billions of dollars out of militarism and put half of it into tax cuts for you guys, and put half of it into useful spending and end starvation on the planet and have good schools and so forth. And they say, no, no, as a matter of principle, we must be against all spending. And so they right. won't go for any sort of compromise proposal like that. So it's if you're out there and you will, let me know.
That's a good point, and I definitely would not necessarily just put that burden on the libertarians, right? I think that the kind of thing you just observed there is present among many different kinds of organizations. And that makes it difficult. Part of the reason is that the movements are organized on this ideological basis. And because they're organized on an ideological basis, that tends to line up with parties. And to the extent that it lines up with parties, that undermines the effectiveness of the movements for all the reasons that we talk about in the book.
I wonder towards the end about the advice that you give to the Occupy movement, because it's not the advice I would give, and I'm not sure if I'm right or wrong, but your advice seems to be if you wanted to grow bigger, you needed to reach out to Democrats and identify with Democrats and make common cause with them, understanding that that was inevitably going to lead to the sort of compromise and collapse that you describe in the peace right. movement. And I wonder whether better advice isn't what we've been talking about on this program, to move people away from partisanship and toward policy.
Well, that's definitely good advice. You know, it's a very delicate line to walk. You know, how does a social movement work with a political party in a way that doesn't allow itself to become co-opted? And I think with the anti-war movement, there was maybe a little bit too much of a willingness to take on the democratic themes. And I guess I would say in the Occupy movement, although I do agree with you, of course, that they want to reach across the whole issue spectrum and reach out to as many different groups of people as they can, I think there were a lot of opportunities for the Occupy movement to have a broader coalition than they did. Because as we all remember, you know, in September, October 2011, is that right?
That's right.
September, October 2011, there was a lot of excitement associated with the Occupy movement. And there were lots of different people that wanted to help and be involved. And in a lot of ways, the Occupy movement turned a very explicit cold shoulder to some of these efforts in a way that alienated some people that might have been supporters. And I think you can remember the evidence that we talk about in the book, and I won't go through that in detail here, but I think the Occupy movement could have reached out to the progressive democratic community and brought them into the movement more than it did, and tried to find a way that would do so in a way that wouldn't be as susceptible to, let's say, co-optation as the anti-war movement was. So it's a difficult balance to strike, and I think that the Occupy movement could have struck it more on the side of reaching out to allies.
It's very good advice and very tricky advice, and I highly recommend that everybody listening get a copy of the book and read it yourself. The book is called Party in the Streets, the Anti-War Movement and the Democratic Party After 9/11. We've been speaking with co-author Michael Heaney. Michael, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.